David Coleman, good morning.
Good morning, Ryan.
Good to see you looking fit, well, healthy. Actually, healthy.
Thanks very much.
Wouldn't
Thanks
say glow,
much.
But not just you don't look like you're suffering from any serious disease.
Which no glow.
No, you don't have a healthy glow.
Jesus.
I've seen you coming in here at the odd time with that surfing hue about you.
Yeah.
But in terms of the glow, it's not there. But,
Thanks very much.
But every time I talk to you,
I don't know what that is. You're missing your glow. That's all right.
No, if you dig deep enough into what I've just said, there's a compliment in there
was
somewhere.
There somewhere.
Yeah. I'm not going to tell you where. Use your own smartphone.
Maybe the listeners could tell me where the compliment was.
Yeah, 51552. You have been, you're always away in some exotic location. So have you been away to some exotic location?
No, we have had one of the quietest summers ever. Because our
work experience guy just came in with the coffee. Very decent. Good man. Thank you.
Thank you.
Even Grace said thank you to him. That's brilliant. He's brilliant, actually.
He was very good at that.
He's very good. The way he dropped it there, it was like a good batsman in a cricket. Not that I know.
More like an old pro than a new man.
I wouldn't call him that now. Fairness, he doesn't know anything about the streets. Sorry, where were you? What were you doing?
No, not a lot, because our eldest son actually had a great summer. He went off on an exchange abroad, and then he went off with the Venture Scouts abroad, and so the rest of us were kind of left behind.
Yeah.
With no real time to actually organise any time to go away. So so we've actually had a summer of being around, and it's been nice. I have to say I've enjoyed it. I did get away sailing on my own for a week, which is great.
Oh, 1 week, yeah. And that was just to let a little...
Just to stretch the legs, so to speak.
we did the week at home last week, and just the gang, and it was the nicest way to
spend. I heard you climb the Sugarloaf.
Yeah, I climbed the Sugarloaf. I thought at the other side when it came down, now I can say I climbed the Sugarloaf. When I got up there, that was 20 minutes. What's the fuss?
Mm.
But it's just trying something. The GPS took me to somebody's backyard. Up the back of the wrong end of the Sugarloaf. Turn left. Are you sure? Turn right. What? Turn. Go straight ahead. What? Into her house? And then eventually came back to have to ask.
And were there other cars there? No.
No.
No, it was actually somebody's house.
There's an official place which is closer to the road up to Roundwood. So got there eventually. But it was a nice thing to do and watch a load of movies too.
Do you know where I was now?
Tell me.
Unusually. I was rock climbing in Killiney.
Oh, I know. Up in the quarry, the old quarry. How was that?
I had never known it existed.
Yeah.
It was fantastic.
Steep looking.
It was great. Yeah, it was good fun. It was just one of those places that I just never knew existed.
Yeah.
The whole Killiney Head, all the walks around there, beautiful.
Yeah, it's lovely, isn't it?
It's a fantastic view over the city, oh my God.
Yeah, and not a million miles away from Dublin town. It's a good spot. Joan, I watched a couple of great... I've been watching most of the summer Louis Theroux documentaries.
Oh, yeah.
I love them. But the two that really struck me, and I would urge people at home to watch these. One was on autism, and the other was on Alzheimer's. And I don't have anyone, thankfully, in my family, luckily, with either of those yet. It may happen, and if it happens, so be it. But just not yet. And yet, I talk to people a lot, even on this show, about it, particularly autism.
Mm.
And I think I got more insight into autism in that 45 minutes than I've ever got talking to anyone or seeing anything in my whole life, and I got a sense of the pain of it, the joy of it, just the families just coming to terms. It was just extraordinary piece of television.
Yeah.
And equally with the Alzheimer's, because there's a woman there, she's 38 getting Alzheimer's, or 34, something about close to that age.
Oh my God.
And she's there smiling and laughing with the husband, and she's pretending, she's laughing, her laughing is nervous laughter, trying to get there. I'm fine. She's not. She goes into the doctor, neurologist, and he says, there's a round circle, and he says, draw a clock in that. And she draws a 12, and underneath it, a 6, sort of, and a 3 beside it. She doesn't, she's all over. And just in that. But just again, the insight into it. So, well worth having a look at if you're looking for something to, just to give you an insight, because you hear autism, it's just a word. But actually, when you get inside it as much as you can, it's fascinating.
Yeah, I actually had a query into the newspaper there recently. And actually, the more I was, reading what I presumed it was a mom writing to me, the more it sounded like her child had some kind of an autistic spectrum disorder.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how all-encompassing and it just sucks in the whole family. You know, it has such an impact on the whole family.
Well, that's one woman in this documentary turned around, and the whatever date, her twins, as it happens, and she said, what pains me most is they don't bring me joy.
Mm.
And that was a really harsh thing to say. And I that stayed with me since I've seen it, because I think it was a spur of a moment. Because later you see her and she clearly, they do bring her joy, and she knows. I think she just had that thing at that moment. She's just, I can't take it anymore, you know, because it's just constant. But anyway, it was all about the inside. I thought I'd share that.
But you see, I mean, you know, if one of the core difficulties, say, for a lot of people with autistic spectrum disorders is to do with their own emotions and making emotional connections. And so therefore, you know, what we strive on in human relationships really is emotional intimacy.
Yes.
I mean, that's what makes human relationships great. And so I'd imagine that's actually what she was saying. It was just that she just
can't
make that connection. You know, even though she's giving it out, it's not necessarily coming back to her, and that's really hard.
And again, you mentioned that thing in the Alzheimer's program. You could see the younger lady who has Alzheimer's, and we've spoken about it on the late actually, when a younger person has it. It was the 9-year-old daughter. And you could see her going, having an ice cream, as the mother was drifting into complete dementia. But it was moments of lucidity, and she was going. And you could see her saying goodbye, essentially. And equally with the autism, there was one of the kids particularly physical and destructive in this section of footage. And his sister, it's the sibling who doesn't have autism, is maybe 9 or 10. And the camera just panned over to a corner of the room, and she was sitting in the room with her head, about not 10 years old, with her head in her hands going, here we go again. You know, everyone has to live with it.
Yeah, if you actually read some of the research as well, that they've done with siblings in families where there's any kind of disability, not necessarily, you know, autism, but just other kinds of disability. Like, it is so hard for the siblings often, because they're in that situation where, you know, they love their brother or sister, but they're also sometimes tormented by them. You know, they feel fiercely protective of them in certain situations, and at other times, you know, just are completely frustrated
and I'd say
by them.
They feel awful saying things like, why can't we just have a normal house? Why can't my friends just come over to our house? Why can't we go on a normal holiday? Why can't we just go to the cinema like everyone else? And then they stop and say, I didn't mean it. But they're entitled to let it out, aren't they?
I know.
You have to. Better out than in. I mean,
and that's the difficulty, because where do you actually have that kind of voice often within those families? Absolutely, because you're going to sound like, you know, you're just being critical, and you know, the parents aren't necessarily going to want to be hearing that either, because it's really hard for them to accept that there's this negative bit as well as you know, some of the positives, and
it brings in all the other questions about what happens when they get older, who looks after, who's next. That is not what we're here to talk about. It was on my mind, and I said you're the guy to share it with. Back to the queries. 51552. David, my daughter of 18 over the summer has and will be attending a lot of parties, boys and drinks and so on, over the next couple of months, as her friends are all 18. Should I send her prepared, for example, with a condom, or put her on the pill? I'm under no illusions as to what it's like out there. I lie awake worried about her. She's a stunning looking girl and attracts attention, says Annie.
You don't necessarily actually have to send her with the condoms or put her on the pill, but you definitely want to have the conversation with her about, you know, kind of her sexual behaviour and other people's sexual behaviour and what she's likely to encounter, particularly if you feel that she's in some way perhaps innocent or maybe naive, or, you know, isn't that conscious of the kind of attention that she draws. Although I would imagine at age 18, she's very conscious of the kind of attention that she draws, and that she's an attractive girl, and that, you know, she's probably had many suitors even already at age 18. So, but absolutely be having the conversation. I mean, you don't need to send your kids out going, you know, look, here's the pack of condoms, you know, make sure you use them. But I mean, you can, but the bigger conversation is just about, you know, her own both sexual and emotional health in terms of relationships. And it's really about putting, you know, kind of sex into that broader context as well of relationships, which I think sometimes we forget to do, you know, even with younger teenagers, perhaps if we're trying to have the talk, we often keep it very limited to, you know, the biology of the whole event, and not necessarily bring it into just that wider conversation about relationships and where sex fits with love and, you know, intimacy and emotional intimacy as well, and all those kinds of things. So I think that's the conversation to be having with your daughter.
I have a 17-year-old lovely and rebellious teenager, but totally well-balanced kid in a very loving home, includes men only, 4 boys. Recently, he told me that he finds it hard to talk about his feelings. So how do I approach this with him? Is this an age thing? Is it a boy thing? I am the go-to parent, as his dad is the lovely old-fashioned man who says nothing. The honest text.
You know, I would say 90% of the Irish population struggle to talk about their feelings or to have, you know, really insightful conversations about, yeah, about what's going on inside. So I suppose the key bit is if you're conscious of what you witness in terms of his moods and his feelings and so on, you can comment on that to him, and that helps him both identify and even begin to label what's actually going on for himself. And actually, the more we show as parents and adults, I think, that we're willing to have a guess at what's going on inside, the easier it becomes for youngsters to actually tell us what's going on inside. And and again, it's a bit like, you know, I was saying, you know, in that family where it might be hard for a youngster to be critical of their sibling, sometimes we just need the right forum, and so as parents we just need to create that space where actually there is a time and a place where actually if you do have something on your mind you can speak it, rather than feeling like life is just too busy, too rushed, and no parent has the time. So if this mom feels she is the go-to parent, that she does I suppose have that capacity to connect with him, well then it's just about making some time and space, you know, and that's harder when they're 17, because you're not going to be going in saying goodnight as you might with a younger child, where you might sit on the edge of the bed and they might have an old chat and tell you about what's gone on in the day and happening in school and so on. So you actually might have to take it. So it might be about saying, well, look, let's you and me head out for coffee then, you know, and whether it be on the drive or whatever, you know, I mean, I was even conscious, I was coming up to Dublin on Thursday evening and I had my son with me, and you know, it's the first time in ages that he and I
had one.
A chance to just chat. And certainly driving, I think, is easier with older teenagers as well, because it's, you know, there's that capacity if they wanted to just plug in the earphones after a while and zone you out. And so they don't have to feel entirely trapped, like, you know, oh my God, now we're having the deep and meaningful, you know, come on, mam or dad, give us a break. But yet, you know, if we don't offer that, they're not necessarily going to come to us looking for it either. And I think we have to offer it. And so that's all that mam needs to do, I think, is just, you know, put herself out there as saying, yeah, look, I'm happy to chat anytime you like. And, you know, I've noticed that you've been, you know, very moody. I've noticed you've been off form, or I've noticed this. And then let him come back and say, well, yeah, you know, there's a lot going on. And then you might begin to discover what's actually happening.
Go for a walk together. The one-on-one. Don't treat it like a Spanish Inquisition. That's when they run a million miles away and say, right, so what's happening with them? Where are you? It's got to be a lot more diplomatic. I'm learning this as I go, by the way. And you might hear something and there's a clue in the opening salvo that you need to... I mean, you really have to be Sherlockian, don't you? Going, okay, get in there now and find out what's... And it's not about wanting to find out just because in a gossipy sense. It's want to make sure that there's peace in the valley. My son is suffering bad separation anxiety at the moment, David. It started when he turned 5 a couple of months ago, at the point now where he's very anxious even if I go to the boot of the car while he's sitting in it. When we're at home, he's constantly calling out to me if he can't see me. Bedtime is tough too. Don't want to get into the habit of letting him fall asleep with myself or my husband beside him, but I do want to be sympathetic to what he's experienced. So any help would be great, from Jenny.
Okay. Well, the key bit actually, Jenny, is to move away from sympathy. You don't have to be sympathetic because you don't feel the same separation anxiety. But what you do have to do, I suppose, is just develop that empathy, which is to recognise that for him, for whatever's going on at his stage, he does miss you and he worries about himself and how he's going to cope and how he's going to be when you're not there. And if he's 5, chances are he's going to school in the next week and a half. And so that'll be another form of separation. And so it might actually be that he's conscious of this transition coming up anyway, because I'd imagine if he is 5 and going to school, that there's been a lot of chat about being 5 and going to school. And so children, you know, they have this sense that something big is going to happen. And sometimes that there's a bit of residual anxiety, you know, that's almost created by all the chat and the gossip that we have about, oh, school and big school. And, you know, your auntie comes in and she's like, oh, big school now. Oh, I hope your teacher's lovely. I hope she doesn't just start, you know, laying down the law from day one and blah, blah. And, you know, he's a 5-year-old child there, has no real sense of what it's all going to be about.
Sure.
So that might be the kind of thing to talk to him about what else is going on in his life. Because if it's only a recent thing, chances are he's a bit worried about something. And actually it's coming out in this kind of separation anxiety that you become his... source of support and comfort. Like, he can only be soothed by your presence. And actually what you want to give him is a sense that he can soothe himself, of course, that he can cope, that he can manage, and that he will be fine. And so I would guess it's something to do with going to school next week.
Okay.
So I'd be chatting to him about that, but not necessarily in building it up into something awful, but just allowing him some space to try and express what his own worries might be about going to school. Because actually, of course, he will be fine, and as will you. But
you know, it's useful to point out to younger listeners, you know, as I always say, stuck in the back of the car, about going back to school and being worried. First of all, you've got to understand, parents and adults worry about two things. One, you going back to school and you're okay. And two, their own going back to work. I always say that adults are just, we're just kids with wrinkles, you know.
Had you a bad night last night?
No, I was actually all right. Yeah, I was all right. Because I don't mind, like, I was quite happy to come. Like, if I was nervous about coming back or was, was upset or something about it, I wouldn't have had a nice night. But actually, I'm lucky in that I like the job and so on. So, no, it's all right. But a lot of adults do that. They get nervous going back to school or back to work. And it is a back to school thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I was trying to explain only yesterday that worrying in itself is a total waste of energy. In the sense that it's totally acceptable. It makes sense that you do it. But when you think about it, it's not going to change anything.
The behaviour, I know.
It's really not. It's just this thing that puts a knot in your tummy that doesn't have to be there.
Yeah, and I think, though, there is a difference sometimes between, you know, what we might call a rational fear and an irrational fear. So if it's the case, for example, that you have a child who has been badly bullied all the way through fourth class and they're going into fifth class, of course they're going to have a rational anxiety about going back to school because they're anticipating the same thing happening again. You know, but where you have a child who has no real sense of what's going to, or there has never been anything bad happening, then it's often just that anticipatory fear. It's that fear of the unknown, what might be. And you're right, that's the one actually that we can just burn up so much unuseful energy, you know, worrying about, because there's actually little we can do until we're actually in the experience. But I guess one of the ways to do it is sometimes to talk to youngsters about the coping strategies that they actually have. And so, you know, if one of their fears is that they're not going to make friends or whatever, you know, talk to them about the ways that they've already shown that they can make friends and how they smile at people and how they, you know, they always look people in the eye, how they're always great for conversation. Yeah. And that these are the skills that will actually sustain them in any kind of situation, school or wherever. But you're right. I think it's that anticipatory anxiety, that fear of the unknown, that's the big one, really.
Yeah, and it consumes. It can be all consumed. All right, we'll take two more before we say goodbye because we have to do other things this morning, I'm afraid. But and I've enjoyed our chat, though.
Ah, you're very welcome.
Shooting the breeze about the world.
Catching up.
Isn't that what it is? Let's do this one. I'm wondering what you would recommend to help a 9-year-old boy overcome a fear of dogs. Fear being a mild word. He is terrified. It's really impacting his life now. Thank you, Louise.
I would suggest that you actually go and get some proper therapy, because if he has a true phobia, a true dog phobia that's built up from whatever the source was, then it's not going to just change by just simply kind of, you know, shoving him in front of a dog. What he actually needs to do is to learn some skills to help himself relax. So he needs to learn how to breathe and use that to kind of reduce the adrenaline. He needs to learn other kind of relaxation skills that he can then bring to bear when he's in a situation with a dog. And what you do is you bring him then through what they call graded exposure, where first of all you help him use these relaxation skills while he's looking at pictures of dogs, and then you hear dogs barking perhaps you know, on a recording, and he uses the same skills to bring down all that adrenaline. And so slowly and gradually he learns that he can actually relax himself in the presence of dogs, and then it becomes possible for him to actually see dogs in the distance, then be close to a dog on a lead, then actually touch a dog, and so on and so forth. So it's that kind of graded exposure that he needs, best done with a proper therapist. So I'd be looking, go to your GP, look for a referral to either the HSE, although I'm sure there's a long waiting list, or to a private practitioner, and look for some kind of cognitive behavioural therapy in terms of phobia and graded exposure.
There's just going to be dogs all your life. They're not going anywhere and you're not going to be able to avoid them. So
and if he's truly terrified, then you know, that he needs a proper structured approach to that.
Okay, here's one for the two kids in the back of the car who refuse to get on, and they're getting on everyone's nerves because they're itchy and scratchy, basically.
Yes.
I have two beautiful kids, 8 and 10, a boy and a girl, and they're great by themselves, but they don't last 5 minutes together without hitting each other, telling tales on each other, or engaging in some form of psychological bullying. It's obviously become very noticeable over the summer holidays, and although it doesn't seem to affect them in any way, it's driving me mad.
Yeah.
We'll end on this one.
Yeah, I could imagine it is actually affecting them too. But, you know, the difficulty is that they're probably stuck now in a kind of a continuing cycle of retaliation, you know, where it's like, you know, I have to get my own back because he's after doing this, she's after doing that. And again, there's another thing there where, you know, sometimes you have to let the bad feelings out before the good ones can come in. So sometimes you actually need to, again, create a bit of a space where they can each have a nice bitch and moan about the other, and that you actually begin to understand what are the real difficulties issues, because sometimes the real difficulty is actually about how they perceive that they are treated relative to their sibling, and that actually that's something that parents sometimes can do something about, because we can begin to treat our kids differently and perhaps more fairly in their eyes, even though I think most of us do a good enough job of trying to be fair, but you know, kids don't always see it that way.
Yeah, of course.
But that's often at the root of a lot of sibling rivalry, is that sense that, you know, the other is getting more or getting something different, and so it's my job to bring them back a peg or two, or it's my job to have a go at them because I can't have a go at you because you're actually the one who's been really mean and unfair. So I think, you know, the mom or dad in that situation needs to just chat to each of them separately, and just actually find out what it is that really bothers them about the other. And then perhaps it might be about bringing them together to realize that actually, you know, this issue or whatever it is that they feel is just this continuous cycle of retaliation. You can actually start from scratch if that's the case, and assuming that you're there ready to intervene. And it might be that you actually have to intervene just to change some of those behaviors. So remind them not to shout, remind them not to poke, remind them not to pinch, all that kind of stuff that you then have to do.
And if that fails, lock them in the garden shed for an hour. All right, David Coleman, thanks so much as well.
Put the armrest down and then build up pillows between in the car.
What you'd really like to say. We'll do that show another time, no doubt. David, thanks so much indeed.
Pleasure.
Good to see you as always. 19 minutes to 11 o'clock.